There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Bukayo Saka, toca para Odegaard, balcón del área, uy que pase para el primero de Odegaard, gol, 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 gol de Martinelli, gol, del Arsenal, lo marca Gabriel Martinelli, ya hay mambo en el Emirates Stadium, Arsenal 1, Liverpool 0. Hay peligro en esa acción a balón parado del Liverpool. Recupera Gabriel Jesús para el Arsenal. Ojo que esto es un 3-3. 49 y medio de partido. Martinelli va con la pelota. Martinelli recorta. Ojo, la deja pasar. ¡Qué bien lo ha hecho Gabriel! ¡Gol de Bukayo Saka! ¡Gol del Arsenal! Saka versus Alisson. Cámara de videojuego para este penalti. Allá va Bukayo Saka con la zurda. Gol. Gol, 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 gol. De Bukayo Saka, que vuelve a poner arriba al Arsenal en el luminoso en Londres. Otra vez ganan los Gunners. Arsenal 3, Liverpool 2. Ya hay mambo en el Emirates Stadium. ¡Gol! 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 ¡Del Arsenal! ¡Gol! 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 ¡Gol de Bukayo Saka! Marca Gabriel Martinelli. Ya hay mambo en el Emirates Stadium.
This is Arsecast Extra.
Hello and welcome to another Arsecast Extra, as always, with James from Gunnerblog. James!
Goodly morning, goodly morning. Goodly morning, goodly morning, goodly morning. Goodly morning, goodly morning, goodly morning. Oh, oh, goodly morning.
Wow. I love it.
A classic.
I love it.
I know, but it, you know, it felt appropriate for this morning. Keep things upbeat, you know, get the rhythm going. Get that Falco funk into our veins early on.
Start strong, like Arsenal yesterday.
Oh boy, did we start strong. That was good, eh? That was good.
It was a great 58 seconds, yeah. Really, really enjoyed it. Listen, the whole thing was, I'm not going to lie, I was about to say the whole thing was brilliant. The whole thing was quite stressful for quite long periods. But such is the nature of big games, and it went our way in the end. So, yeah, really fantastic day.
I fluctuated between, like, almost ridiculously supreme confidence at times and sheer terror. But I do think towards the end of the game, I think when we got to 3-2, I think people have had some doubts about Liverpool, haven't they? They've had some questions about their form and their results and everything else. But that was not Liverpool that, not the Liverpool of the last few years, where you're 3-2 up and then you just end up getting pressed and harried and hassled and all that kind of stuff. There was something missing. So it did make those last few minutes a little less terrifying than they might have ordinarily been, although the sort of 7 minutes of injury time at the end did make me a bit scared.
Yeah, but I agree with you, actually, that final period of the game was relatively comfortable, and I think Arsenal as well deserve great credit for that, for the way that they handled it. But it was, just a really fantastic result. I mean, I think, fair play to you. I think when we were doing our predictions a couple of weeks ago, you very bullishly said we would beat Spurs and beat Liverpool.
Did I?
Maybe. You certainly said we'd beat Liverpool, I think.
Right.
So I take my hat off to you.
Chapeau?
Chapeau.
Wow.
As they say.
A chapeau. Amazing. Can this day get any better? Yes, it can, because we're going to relive what happened yesterday at the Emirates. Let's start with a bit of team news, where Mikel Arteta sprang something of a surprise by picking Takehiro Tomiyasu at left back. And look, it raised some eyebrows. Certainly on my Twitter timeline, it raised some eyebrows, and people were going, why? Kieran Tierney's fit. He played well the other night. Why are you playing Tomiyasu there? Mohamed Salah coming off the pitch at 69 minutes tells you that Mikel Arteta got that decision very, very right. And Tomiyasu is he's just such a good player, such an accomplished defender. I really enjoy watching him defend. You know, when there's a duel, Mikel Arteta is not upset because he wins the duels. But it's still a big call, wasn't it? You know, you could see the logic of it, where he's playing a right-footed defender against a left-footed player on the right who likes to cut inside. So you've got strong foot against strong foot, if you like. But, I mean, he absolutely had Salah in his pocket for the whole game. It was a fantastic performance from Tomiyasu and a great decision from Arteta.
Yeah, and to be fair, I think Arteta has done this before, or similar things before. You know, I remember him playing Ainsley Maitland-Niles up against Riyad Mahrez, I think, for Manchester City. Might have done it against Salah as well in the Community Shield as a kind of left wing back. I think he has even played Cedric as a left back against a left-footed right winger. So it's something we've seen him do in the past. And there might have been a match last season where he did it with Tomiyasu.
Well, I think it was Newcastle, but I don't know that it was necessarily tactical. I think this was tactical.
I don't mean that one. I think there was another occasion I'm thinking of.
Right, okay.
Anyway, he does do this thing where he plays a right footer against a left footed right winger. It kind of matches up the inversion. But I also think, you know, I do wonder how much of it is just down to the fact that he thinks Tomiyasu is his best one to one defender. You know, in those duels, I'm not sure Arsenal have anybody better. He's so effective at winning the ball back. And there are a couple of early challenges in this game. You know, I think 5 minutes in, he just won a big towering header at the far post. And after about 15 minutes, there was a one-on-one with Salah. He came out on top. All the crowd got off their feet. He had a really fantastic game and absolutely, you know, demonstrated that Arteta was right to pick him.
Yeah, I don't even think it's completely about the left-footer versus right-footer thing, because part of where Liverpool are effective and have been effective is how well they switch the play, that big diagonal, you know, which can go over the fullback. Tomiyasu's reading of the game and the way that he can position himself and make the header, he makes it look very simple, but it's not. It really isn't. It's he's just a brilliant defender. Like,
I also think on the ball, you know, again, this is not to detract from Kieran Tierney, who I thought was excellent in the week, but I think Tomiyasu on the ball gives you weirdly kind of more closer to Zinchenko in terms of his, you know, willingness to come inside. He's very two-footed, very good passer, very clean technically. I think he helps in that respect as well. You know, I don't think that this is now, he's now the de facto second choice left back and we're never going to see Kieran Tierney again or anything like it. I think he was just the right man for this game.
Sure.
Credit to Arteta for making that call. I'm sure Kieran Tierney would have been extremely disappointed to miss out on this one, but you can't really argue with the performance that Tomiyasu put in.
No, absolutely not. And maybe now the guys on Sky Sports who do the transfers can figure out what Tomiyasu is. Maybe.
Or maybe they can't, because frankly, he's so good everywhere he plays. Do you know what I mean? I mean, is he a right back? Is he a left back? Is he a
centre
back?
Nobody knows. Nobody
could be any.
Fuck those guys. Right. An amazing start to the game. With a goal in less than 60 seconds. Yeah. And it's quite, look, football is a bit weird because, like, it can be a split second. It can be like a ball that bounces one way that, you know, takes you off your axis, whatever it is. And it's quite possible that before we scored this goal, I think William Saliba had a heavy touch. And it could have gone the other way. It's one of those that could easily have gone the other way. And we've seen occasions like that, you know, loads of times where the ball just breaks for the opposition and all of a sudden you're in trouble. But they took a heavy touch too. Saliba gave it to Saka, Saka to Martin Odegaard. What a pass that is for Martin Odegaard for Gabriel Martinelli. He didn't even need to break his stride before he just ran onto the ball and put it beyond Alisson. You know, superb goal, superb team goal, but, you know, just so efficient in terms of how it happened. As soon as Saka got the ball, drives forward, he knows Odegaard is going to be in support, and Martinelli's run that he makes, you know, into the box, and we've seen him do it more than once this season, it's such a threat, and his pace, his timing, all of it so good, and the pass from Odegaard, what a brilliant way to start the game.
Yeah, it was. I mean, Saliba, like you said, almost gave the ball away and then showed customary composure to kind of get it under control, play it out. Saka was driving at Van Dijk, and Van Dijk, I don't think, really wanted to know about it, to be honest. He was backing off. That's one of the things about Saka. I think even, you know, even though there have been games this season where maybe he's not been at the very top of his game, he has got that fear factor. You know, he frightens people with the way he runs with the ball. They back away from him. They find Odegaard. I mean, the Liverpool defensive shape is a mess, really, at this particular point in time. We talked about the Arsenal team news. The slightly surprising Liverpool team news was they stuck with a team with basically four up front. I mean, it was almost a 4-2-4 at times. Arsenal hugely overloaded them on that particular right side, on that attack. And the pass from Odegaard's brilliant. I mean, it's almost like hurling or something. Do I mean hurling? Curling, I mean. Sorry, wrong sport.
Yeah, the hurling's a bit more frantic,
Yeah, like the way it sort of skids along the ground but comes to a stop just in Martinelli's stride. It's so perfectly weighted. And, yeah, a great moment for Martinelli, who I thought had an outstanding performance.
Oh, my God. Yeah, I mean, he had two Liverpool fullbacks on toast for the duration of the game. Trent, obviously, is going through a difficult period, but he couldn't handle him, and Joe Gomez couldn't handle him either. Yeah, I mean, just a brilliant way to start the game. And this first goal is always such an important one. Liverpool now have conceded the first goal in 10 of their last 12 Premier League games, which is astonishing. You know, if it happened in, you know, five games, you'd say, ooh, that's a bit of a problem. This, I don't quite know what it is, whether it's a psychological thing you've got to overcome, but clearly they're having some difficulties. And I do wonder if in the build-up to the game, that was something that the manager stressed to his players, like the potential to score the first goal against Liverpool is as high as it ever was.
I think so. And Arsenal are starting games pretty well at the present point in time. I think they're coming out the blocks pretty effectively. And Liverpool have got this remarkable record of going behind. I mean, it is interesting. They do seem to have lost a lot of their defensive stability. I don't think Van Dijk looks close to as comfortable as he did. Fabinho's not even getting in the team, which I think tells you something about the quality of his performances this season. It's been a massive drop-off in his form. So, yeah, they are sort of there to be got at. And Trent, like you say, is just in one of those periods where you almost feel for a player, you know, because everything's going against them.
Yeah.
But Arsenal took advantage. They got that early goal. And to give Liverpool some credit, I actually thought they stabilised pretty effectively after that. You know, it's kind of a strange half, really, because Arsenal went in front, but I think Liverpool probably certainly had the better of the possession and better of the territory, I think, for most of the half.
I think so. Certainly, you know, after about 10, 15 minutes, they got a hold of the game in a way that, you know, I wasn't entirely comfortable with. I don't know that they were hugely threatening all the time, but certainly, you know, they were very tidy in midfield. I'm not sure our midfield was working as well as it should have. You know, certainly when you look at the quality of Partey, Odegaard and Xhaka, to sort of, I don't want to say they got the runaround from Thiago and Henderson, but certainly they controlled the game pretty well for Liverpool without sufficient pressure from Arsenal. There was that moment.
Thiago was ghosting around, wasn't he, making lots of problems for Arsenal. I think the system Liverpool played with the kind of, you know, four up top or one off the striker, I think that presented Arsenal with some problems, particularly Thomas Partey, who was under massive pressure, you know. And I thought ultimately he came through in a really impressive fashion, but it was more congested than he's accustomed to in that part of the pitch. And I think that played into Liverpool's hands a bit.
Well, sure, yeah. And you could, like, nominally it's a two, but if you're playing three then exactly. behind the striker, that can be five.
Exactly.
And Jota was dropping into some dangerous positions as well. Very nice to keep that fucker from scoring a goal yesterday as well. That's just something that occurred to me now. There's another little cherry on top of the icing on the cake. What about the penalty shout from a Liverpool perspective? Gabriel handball.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
I thought it might be given, I'll be honest.
So
when they reviewed it
and
I saw the replay, I thought, ooh. You know, I've seen them given, certainly.
I think you see more of them given than not given.
Yeah.
You know, but at the same time, like, Gabriel was very close to him, so there's an issue of proximity, isn't there? And then the stuff about, like, his hand is not in a natural position. But, like, that doesn't make much sense to me, really. It never has made a great deal of sense to me. Like, if a guy is sliding in to block a shot. Do you remember there was one last season? Was it last season? Where I think it was Cedric took a shot and the defender slid in and had his arm out above his head and the ball hit his hand. I think that is a much more obvious hand not in a natural position than if you're a defender, if you're standing in the box, if you're trying to stand up against a guy who's twisting and turning, as you adjust yourself, as you twist and turn, you need your arms for balance. That hand was not in an unnatural position to me. It was a natural position based on the movement in the box. You know, if you're standing with your hands behind your back, that's unnatural.
But, absolutely.
But that's not how humans work.
No, exactly. I mean, I think holding your arms by your side or behind your back is, as you say, unnatural in that situation. The proximity, I think, is what saves Gabriel here. You know, it's when you look at the replay, it's very close to him that the ball is struck. But I can't lie, I was relieved that it passed without a penalty, you know?
Yeah, well, me too. And look, sometimes you get decisions that go for you and sometimes, you know, they go against you. And we've been on more than enough of the bad decisions for us to get a little bit of, I won't say good fortune from the referee, but for it to go our way. The first half, like, by the time we headed towards the injury time and everything else, I was sitting there thinking, just get in at 1-1, let the manager sit down, let him talk to the players, let him address the couple of issues that we have in terms of control and what we're going to do about Liverpool when they're in possession and how we're going to combat that and everything else. Then they get that free kick and I'm thinking, just clear it, just get rid of it. You know, if it comes in, just hoof it, we go in 1-1, we sort ourselves out.
Should we touch on their goal before we get to this? Or?
Oh, yeah. Fuck, I forgot all about their goal.
I mean, listen, I don't like talking about the opposition.
Yeah. I'd forgotten all about that. To be fair, it was kind of coming in a way, wasn't it? There were a couple of warning signs. There was the Saliba.
Well, that was almost identical, weirdly.
Yeah.
Ball into a channel, cross came in. Saliba looking for another own goal. But, it was a similar sort of shaped move.
Yeah.
Just a few moments before they did get back into the game. I mean, Gabriel, I've seen quite a lot of criticism of Gabriel on that one. What did you make of it?
I think he should have dealt with that better, for sure. He should have, you know, that was a very, just an up and under, if you like, from Trent. It wasn't it wasn't one of his precision long balls or anything like that. I think you've got to defend that better, you know, if you're Gabriel. You can't let that bounce, and we paid the price for it. A little bit unlucky in the sense that the cross went between Saliba's legs. It could easily have just sort of, you know, bounced off him and gone out for a corner.
It was super clinical, I think, from their perspective. You know, good cross, good finish.
I think the finish is lucky. I don't know that he means to do that, does he? Do you think he does?
I don't know. If he does, it is a good finish.
I suppose. If he did mean it, it's a good finish. If he didn't, it's just a kind of clumsy boot into the ground. I enjoyed his, in the aftermath of the game, I enjoyed his celebration. Do you know, is that something he does all the time? Is that like his trademark celebration? You're crying, ha ha ha. Because it doesn't stand up when you lose a game, does it?
No. I don't know. I think he does. I think he does do it. But he hadn't scored for, since the opening day. So I wonder if it was about, related to his own situation. But I think in the wake of a defeat, it doesn't look great.
No. Right. So we're getting to our goal then, now that we've got that horrible business
that
out of the way.
Blip
out of the way. And look, I think you're right. Liverpool were on top in that first half. But Arsenal as a counter-attacking team are making real progress. It's something we're very good at now, those quick transitions, the way we got the ball out to the wide areas. Martinelli showed his pace, didn't he, earlier in the game when I think there was a race with Diaz. Mm. And I actually think Diaz is a little bit unlucky to get booked, because in real time, it looks like an obvious foul. But I think Martinelli trips himself up.
Yeah,
when you look at the replays, and it didn't matter much in the grand scheme of things, but that pace that he showed on the break was really something. When you see Arsenal break forward at pace like that, you see Martinelli one side, you see Saka the other side, you don't always expect to see Gabriel, big Gabby, as the man in the middle making the break forward.
No, and that's a moment where he just sees the initiative. And we know that he's quite an emotional player on the pitch, and it's one of those where you almost wonder if, the goal we've conceded and his potential part in it plays into his decision there. I mean, he sees the ball sort of moving into the opposition half, and he thinks, sod it, I'm just going to go, and he keeps on going. He ends up about 6 yards out from goal. But it's a really important intervention because, again, as the first goal, it creates an overload. It creates a numbers imbalance that Liverpool are not in a position to deal with. And Martinelli does brilliantly, takes Henderson and Trent out of the game with a really nice little turn. A genius step over from Gabriel.
It actually is. I mean, it's a deliberate thing that he does there. It's very smart. I don't think Trent defends that particularly well. But what I reckon he's anticipating there is Martinelli, given the way that he's been playing and given what he's capable of, I think he's absolutely expecting Martinelli to roast Henderson on the outside and go beyond him. So he's moving out to try and anticipate that. And of course, like you say, Martinelli cuts back inside. It's a very good ball across. The dummy from Gabriel is really, really good. And there's Bukayo Saka at the back post to make it 2-1. And, a goal just before halftime is always a good time to score a goal, particularly when you're looking and maybe just hoping that you're going to get in at 1-1 and not behind, actually. So, I didn't expect that, but obviously delighted by it.
Yeah, and I think it was not an ideal half from Mikel Arteta's perspective. He looked quite animated on the touchline and giving out a lot of instructions, trying to put things right. But it's also worth saying, as you did, that even though Liverpool probably had the better of the half, Arsenal always threatened on the break. They always threatened in those moments of transition. If Odegaard got on the ball, if Saka and Martinelli were running in behind, they were a perennial problem for Liverpool, even when they were dominating the ball. And I think it's really interesting because we've seen Arsenal win a lot of games by sort of taking the game to their opponent and, being the team with the majority of the possession, having all the territory. But this first 45 minutes showed that they can kind of do it both ways. They can be a team that thrives in transition too. And that was really encouraging in its own way. But I think Liverpool probably would have been very disappointed to have gone in at half-time 2-1 down, given their performance, and Arsenal absolutely elated. I mean, when the half-time whistle blew, they sprinted down the tunnel, Arsenal.
They did.
It was almost like they knew, right, we've absolutely got away with one there. That's an exaggeration, but we're in a slightly fortuitous position. Let's get in and sort out some of the issues that we're having on the field so that we can consolidate this.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I did notice that as well. I think we had a question about that, which I probably can't find right now. Boom, boom, boom. No, I can't find it. Oh, Sam Rat, who's on Twitter, at SamChez7, who said, what did you make of the players rushing to the dressing room at halftime, even though we were leading? It seemed the players realized they were under the cosh far too long for their liking in the first half. A good change in mentality. And, maybe they just wanted to run down the tunnel laughing their heads off. But, I do agree that there's something in the way that they react to not just difficult moments, but good moments as well, to try and make the most of them.
And it's becoming a regular occurrence at the Emirates Stadium. But when Liverpool equalised, there's that sort of initial moment of silence and disappointment. And then the crowd was straight away rallying the troops again. And that is the position Arsenal have got themselves into now, where the supporters have such faith and such belief in them that, an opposition goal is not enough to puncture the atmosphere. And I think that's been hugely important.
I was going to say, we've talked about this at length and more than once this season, so I don't want to go over it too much again. But, Mikel Arteta said it's the best atmosphere, that he's ever experienced. And I think we had let me just see if I can get it up here. True Story_4 said, I didn't think we could beat last week's North London Derby atmosphere, but we did, just as loud. But we raised the roof and, roared on the boys even when Liverpool were on top. Is this just the new normal now? I hope it is, because it's an amazing thing to experience. When you go over for a game, and when I was there last week, it was truly fantastic. And obviously results play a big part in how people are feeling, and you've won 8 games from 9, in the season, everyone's going to feel good. But it's all connected, isn't it? There's something joined up in the way that everything is feeling, the sensations, the atmosphere, all of it. You can see it whether you're there or not.
Yeah, and I've heard a few people saying this morning and last night, the atmosphere is as good as it's been since Arsenal were at Highbury, which, is nearly 20 years ago now.
Oh, fuck.
It is quite an extraordinary development. And, I think our atmosphere at the Emirates Stadium has been a little bit unfairly maligned at times.
Yeah.
But no one is questioning the volume and the intensity of the atmosphere that you get at Arsenal these days. It is a really exciting place to be. And I think anyone who can get a ticket for any game at the present point in time is very fortunate, because it's just a superb thing to be a part of. I was working yesterday, I was in the press box, so I was maybe less a part of it than I was for the North London Derby. But in a funny way, it sort of enabled me to kind of sit back from it and sort of, watch it more as a spectator. And I was just struck by, the passion that pours forward from the stands. And, that Saliba chant to the tequila song, it's actually a very difficult song for the whole stadium to sing in unison.
Yeah, because it's a simple, one side is doing the whoa, and then they're slightly ahead.
So what happened yesterday is like to the do-do-do-do-do-do bit would be kind of quite out of sync. But then when it got to like the do-do-do-do-do, it would create like, if somehow it would all kind of sync up at that point in time, and there would be like a wall of noise. Like, it was extraordinary. Like the stadium was vibrating. And I don't think I ever thought I'd really say that of the Emirates. And I don't mean to be disparaging, but just because it is one of those more modern bowl-like arenas, because of the size of it, because of the necessary sort of distance of the supporters from the pitch, I just never thought it would feel quite like this. And so it's really special, and I'm hugely appreciative to be there and partake in it. And it's down to lots of different things.
Sure.
But results are, of course, a part of it. But it's great, because it becomes this sort of positive cycle where it all just feeds each other and it keeps building.
Well, long may it last. Long may it last. Second half, I think Arsenal were a lot better. There was a very early chance, wasn't there, for Martin Odegaard, when he shot straight at the goalkeeper, and I think he probably should have done better, the way he put his head in his hands, you know, he knew that he should have done better in that situation. And then a couple of minutes later, Liverpool are level again. And look, I love William Saliba as much as the next man or woman, but he's still 21. There are going to be games where he goes through things or things happen which are teachable moments, learnable moments for him. And the way Firmino ran off the back of him there, I think that's one of those. It was an illustration as well, I think, of how incisive Liverpool still can be, despite not being perhaps the Liverpool we've all hated. I don't know if that's the right word, but we've all seen, I guess, over the last few years. You know, they're still a dangerous team, and it only takes three or four passes to open you up, and you can you pay the price. I mean, it's a very, very good finish, I think, from Firmino with his left foot. I mean, the goalkeeper has got no chance on that.
It's in the side netting, yeah. Isn't it? I think it was an interesting start to the half because Arsenal actually came out the blocks flying again. There was the Odegaard chance you mentioned, one of the rare opportunities where perhaps he could have passed rather than shot. There were two good Van Dijk blocks to deny Saka and Odegaard. There was an opportunity where Jesus was just offside. And
yeah.
In my match notes, I've just written LFC shaky. Is this the moment? You know, it really felt like Arsenal were going to push on and get a goal. And then the Liverpool goal came as a bit of a sucker punch, really. I mean, it was against the run of play. I'd say it was almost as against the run of play as Arsenal's second goal was. And actually, it was interesting. As Arsenal kind of sensed a potential goal to go 3-1 up in the game, they just became a tiny bit stretched. And I could see Arteta on the sidelines kind of communicating a lot about distances and trying to keep the team compact and not get drawn into chasing that third goal. Because I think they sensed a vulnerability in Liverpool, who'd made a change at the back and looked quite chaotic in their own penalty box. And then, yeah, a moment of real quality from them to get that equalising goal. And I agree with you that Saliba gets done there. And I think I do think that the sort of the standing and the affection in which our two centre halves are held is a little bit feeding the narrative around their performances, to be honest. I think Saliba has been better than Gabriel, but I think if Gabriel made the mistake Saliba made on that goal, he'd be absolutely castigated for it, you know?
Yeah, maybe so. Look, he is the flavour of the month, no two ways about it, and you tend to get a bit more leeway, and I'm not being critical of him for that. For that goal, because he is still very young for a central defender. As we've said before, to do what he is doing at the age of 21 is extraordinary, because you very rarely see central defenders at that age with his level of composure, with the way he reads the game most of the time. But, you know, there are going to be times where things don't go as well as they could. And this is where he develops and this is where he learns. And, you know, as he gets older and hopefully stays at Arsenal with a brand new contract, you know, we see the benefits of that. So, yeah, I mean, I think that's just sort of, that's normal. But I liked our response to the Liverpool goal. Like you say, it wasn't helter-skelter. We didn't go all out, but there was a real bravery in the way that we played.
Yeah.
Like, you could fully understand if, after everything we've been through against Liverpool in the last couple of years, when it went to 2-2, we got a bit shaky. And we got a bit, you know, weirded out by, oh, well, maybe a point is okay against Liverpool because we haven't beaten them in so long and a point would be fine. But we played like a team that knew we were capable of taking 3 points from this Liverpool team. There were moments, weren't there? There was Granit Xhaka whacked one over. It was a really nice piece of skill in the box. Clipped it over. I think it was Matip at that point. There was a moment when Saka, almost a carbon copy of the goal, but I think he handled the ball. It bounced up and hit him on the hand.
That's right.
And then Liverpool took off Salah. And I do think there's something to this substitution, you know? That you can look at what's going on as you know, look at what the opposition do, you know, play your own game and all that kind of stuff. But when they take off Salah, it would be like, you know, a team that was playing Arsenal and you take off Thierry Henry. Like, even if he's having a quiet game, he's got the quality to score a goal, not necessarily out of nothing, but players of that caliber have the ability to decide games one way or the other. And I think Arsenal were emboldened by the removal of Salah. You know, not just from the perspective that I think it made Liverpool weaker, even if he was getting nothing out of Tomiyasu, I think it made them weaker as an attacking force. And Arsenal capitalized on that because that period between, when did he come off? 69 minutes. And we started then to turn the screw and we played so much of the game in their half, you know, and that sort of space between the Liverpool right back and the right-sided centre half where Xhaka and Martinelli were there and they were there again and there was a shot and there was a cross and I think it was Konate made a very good block from a low Xhaka cross. But we were in that area relentlessly until such time as we got the penalty. And I think the fact that Klopp took Salah off played a big part in that.
Yeah, it was really interesting. It was a double change, wasn't it? Salah and Matip came off and they brought on Konate and Fabinho. So two, you know, a centre-half and a defensive midfielder, yeah, effectively. And at that precise point in time, I looked over to the Arsenal subs bench and just when the penalty was awarded, Arsenal were preparing to bring on Fabio Vieira. So at a time when Liverpool, which I was sort of quite taken aback by, I was like, wow, okay, we're really going for this. You know, at a time when Liverpool were bringing on defensive players and trying to shut down and secure a draw, Arsenal were going to bring on a creative attacking player to try and win it.
Yeah.
And I think that tells you all about where the emphasis was. And that's big boy stuff, really, to be level with Liverpool. 20 minutes to go, 11 aside. You know, it's a topsy-turvy game. Both teams are a threat in their own way and think, no, we're going to play our hand. We're going to go for it. It's pretty ballsy and tells you something about the belief that Arteta and Arsenal have right now.
No, for sure. The confidence that the players have. And I think as well, you know, the confidence that the manager has in the players to be able to go and do that. Because, look, we've seen during Mikel Arteta's time in charge, there have been moments where he has lent into pragmatism, right? Where he sort of said, okay, well, this is as far as we can go, or this is as much as we can do with these players, and we will be maybe a little bit more cautious than people might like. Whereas yesterday, it was like, okay, it's here. It's here for us. You know, a draw would be a good result against Liverpool, but a win will mean something a little bit special. And the fact that we were willing to go for it, the fact that we did it, and we're rewarded for that ambition, I think is really pleasing because, you know, football fans, they'll tell you, I don't mind how we win as long as we win, right? And that's reasonable. But I think most of us want to see a team that's ambitious, that plays attacking football, that tries to win games. And that's what we're seeing with this Arsenal team right now, that there's something just really fun about the way that we are playing and what we're doing and how we're doing it and these characters, these players that we all like and can identify with, you know, whether we really know them or not. We know what they're giving us on the pitch. We know what they're trying to do for the football club, and that's what we identify with, I think, most of all. But it's very pleasing, you know, when like, we could have shut up shop and gone for 2-2. We could have done the Rob Holding thing. You know, we didn't even do the Rob Holding thing when it was 3-2.
No, he was warming up, but he didn't push the button.
Look, it's fine to have Rob Holding warming up in those circumstances. It's absolutely a good common sense thing to do, but we didn't do it. You know, when Gabriel Jesus got a knock, we replaced him with Eddie Nketiah. We didn't bring on another defender, you know, to shut up shop. And you know, there's something very good about that in, you know, when you consider where the team is going to go and how it's going to get there, that kind of mindset, I think, is important.
Absolutely. I really think when Liverpool made those changes, Arteta sensed a vulnerability, and you know, he and Arsenal went for it and they got their reward. Although, I have to be honest, I do think the penalty that we got was a really soft one.
Maybe, yeah, maybe so. It was, you know, it was not as stone cold as some of them, but you know what? Maybe it's the kind of penalty you get when you're the home team and you've got the crowd behind you and there's that atmosphere swirling around the stadium and you're trying to actively win the game.
Yeah,
that's absolutely the kind of penalty you get. Bukayo Saka. Obviously, the framing of him taking a penalty will be for some time the Euros final.
Mm-hmm.
And I understand why. But I wonder how long it will be before we can put that to bed, because since then, he scored a penalty against Chelsea, scored a penalty against Man United, and he scored a penalty yesterday in very high-pressure circumstances. And I was really confident that he was going to score. What about you?
Oh, wow. I wasn't at all.
Really?
I was like Aaron Ramsdale. I could barely watch.
Jurgen Klopp didn't watch.
And yeah, I saw that as well. Yeah. No, I was. I have to. I'll be brutally honest. I wasn't confident. Alisson's wow. pretty good on penalties. And I just am not in a place yet where I have kind of unswerving faith in Saka as a penalty taker.
How many more is it going to take?
Quite a lot more, probably. Like, do you know what I mean? Like, a good penalty taker is a good penalty taker over 50 penalties, not over 5. But this was a ballsy penalty and a really good one. Don't get me wrong. This was one of the first penalties where I was like, that's a really good penalty. You know what I mean? Like, he scored some penalties and I've been like, oh, I'm glad that went in. But this was a really good penalty.
It was, because Alisson did the thing where he stood a little bit to his left and said, you go to the bigger space to my right.
Yeah.
And Saka said, okay, I'll do that.
Well, Saka kind of gives him the eyes as well. If you watch it back, I'm convinced Saka looks at the opposite corner as he runs up. I mean, Alisson doesn't buy it, as it turns out. Mm. So it's got to be a really good strike. But it was a really good strike in a pressure moment. And yeah, I do hope we can stop talking about the Euros now, because, you know, it is quite some time ago.
Yeah.
And I think he's put it behind him. It's just a question of whether kind of television coverage has.
Not yet. And that was very clear in the commentary on the US feed of the game from Peter Drury, which I've seen doing the rounds with some sort of dramatic, heart-rending music on it. But I think it's just worth playing on its own, just the commentary. So I have it here. We'll play this and we'll come back after this.
Now, this is one brave boy, Bukayo Saka, because this is one pressure penalty. He has experienced pressure from the spot like few others. He has suffered for that pressure. But now the Emirates braces itself for a perhaps pivotal kick of the football. These are broad shoulders. This is courage. A sporting moment in time. Bukayo Saka. Such poise! Such noise!
There you go. I like the way he said such noise and then just let the noise of the crowd go in.
I mean, I'll be honest, listening to that, I felt nervous all over again, Andrew. It was a hell of a ride. But great. I mean, great commentary. Good commentary is an art form, I do think.
I don't know if you've noticed, but I think he's got a little bit of a tick, Peter Drury, because he sort of mentions a moment in time. I just wonder, does he get up in the morning and go, this is a coffee in time. This is breakfast in time. But look,
he doesn't undersell the drama.
No, he certainly doesn't. And you know what? I'd much rather listen to him than Martin Tyler and Gary Neville, who you thankfully would not have experienced yesterday, but many of us did, and it was torturous.
Oh, really? So,
yeah, it was just these two.
I think it was a big moment for Saka and a big moment for Arsenal. You know, they were given an opportunity and they took it, and yeah, it was fantastic. And I think as well for him, who's had this season where, you know, people have been looking at him and saying, is he at the level? Is he doing everything he can do? Two goals in a defeat of Liverpool is going to give him all the confidence in the world, isn't it?
Yeah, look, I don't think he is quite at his best form. But in 11 appearances this season, a couple of them are, you know, cameos in the Europa League as well. He has, I think it's 3 goals and 4 assists, mm-hmm. 7 goal involvements in 11 games. And if that's Bukayo Saka not at his best, then let's lick our lips and wait for when he is at his best, because, you know, what he could produce and what he can produce in this team at 21 years of age is amazing.
Oh, and another thing on the penalty, by the way, he had to wait an awful long time to take it.
Oh, he did, yeah.
Which added to the, you know, the sense of drama.
There was a clip doing the rounds. Did you see Van Dijk tried to knock the ball out of his hands and Martinelli sort of ushered Van Dijk away, just got in the way. You know, the usual sort of nonsense players get up to try and psych somebody out. But, you know, he wasn't fazed at all. He just said, I knew what I was going to do with it. I think he said something like that anyway. I knew what I was going to do with the penalty and I just stuck to it and put it in. Like, yeah, a big moment for him. A big moment for Arsenal. I'm not sure there's anything else we necessarily need to talk about in the game, but that we haven't already mentioned. I mean, you know, the last 15 minutes, yes, a bit nervy, but not the Liverpool we've come to know. I expected more. You know, I expected us to be a bit under the cosh, but then they've taken off, you know, their best player. So
they're having a very, very strange season in the Premier League. They've won 2 of their 8 games, which is kind of extraordinary when you think about how brilliant they were last season. It's kind of incredible how quickly the wheels can come off. I don't doubt that they will come good and they'll, you know, reassert themselves as the season wears on. But when you've got teams picking up quite as many points as Arsenal are, and of course Manchester City are, it's a real problem for Liverpool. But Arsenal did their job really effectively too, and I thought, you know, they changed the shape a bit, didn't they? They brought on Tierney and Tomiyasu went into a back three.
Yeah.
You know, they toyed with the possibility of bringing on Holding, didn't do it, brought on Nketiah, brought on Vieira to energise the front line. And I thought they managed the situation pretty well. I mean, you know, Liverpool, they wanted a penalty, but I thought that was clearly a dive. Was it Harvey Elliott with Kieran Tierney?
Yeah, it was a dive. Was a dive, yeah. 100%.
And I apart from that, I don't really think there were too many nervy moments in our box.
No. Ramsdale really didn't have anything to do. Didn't have a save to make, really. And the stats were, you know, post-game, the stats were really something, weren't they? Let me just get up here because I took a screenshot of the graphic they put up on Sky. 11 shots to 8 from an Arsenal perspective. 7 on target, 3 for Liverpool. Expected goals, XG 2.99 for Arsenal, 1.13 for Liverpool. And I've seen elsewhere that that's been downgraded. 46 touches in the opposition box for Arsenal compared to 19 for Liverpool.
Well, that's really telling, isn't it?
It is.
Especially not having most of the ball to get that many touches in the opposition box.
44% possession for Arsenal, 56% for Liverpool, and we still had 46 touches in the opposition box. What do you, or how do you then categorize is the wrong word.
Evaluate.
That's exactly the word I'm looking for here. Because look, last weekend, Arsenal won the derby, and that's brilliant because, you know, we beat Spurs and that's always good and everyone has a good time when you do that. But you've got to beat the big teams too. And given our recent record against Liverpool, it felt something like a millstone around our neck, didn't it? Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. we go to Anfield, we do all right for a little while, and then we collapse and we, you know, let in four goals, or, you know, we'd be three down in half an hour, whatever it might be. Like, I think when you're looking at the progress this team is making, you look at games like this as evidence of how competitive you can be. And if you can compete with Liverpool, even if they've been below par, then you know you're kind of going in the right direction in a fairly significant way, right? It's a little bit similar to the Man City game on New Year's Day, which ultimately we didn't win, you know, but on the day we played some very, very good stuff against, you know, the best team in the country. And this was, I think, I can't call it a defining victory because we don't know what's coming next. But I do think it's the kind of victory that instills the sort of belief and confidence in the squad that will allow them to think they can go to another level and another level and to, you know, stay competitive and, you know, maybe push Man City. I don't know. It's a long season. It's a tall order. We all know that. But I don't know that when you look at the Premier League right now, if you're Arsenal, you respect every opposition, but I don't think we should fear any anymore. And that's a real change from where we were not too long ago.
Yeah. And, you know, you mentioned that Man City game. Arsenal played that game without fear and they didn't get the result ultimately, but that's why it was so energising for us to watch. And, you know, Liverpool, yes, they beat us in this fixture last season, but for 45 minutes, we went toe-to-toe with them, as I recall.
Mm.
And it could have been a very different outcome. And so this does feel like a continuation in that process of sort of establishing ourselves amongst the good teams in this league.
Yeah.
I think it's worked in our favour that we've played Tottenham and Liverpool at home, certainly. You know, we've spoken about the atmosphere and what that does for the team and the environment. And when we went to Old Trafford, you know, I thought we played all right on that day, but we were beaten. You know, we go to Stamford Bridge in a few weeks' time. That will be an interesting test of our mettle. Can we replicate the performances and results that we're able to generate at the Emirates Stadium elsewhere at these big grounds, or little grounds in the case of Stamford Bridge? That's the next step for this team. But I think results like this will only help in that quest. And yeah, it, you know, a matter of days ago, we were looking at Spurs and Liverpool back to back and thinking, is this when we're going to come back down to earth with a bump? And we haven't. And so it's a very good time right now to be an Arsenal fan. There's just so much to be positive and excited about.
For sure, for sure. And it's a big win, a big 3 points, puts us back on top of the table, you know, again, above a Manchester City team who everyone is saying are this sort of relentless machine of a team who will, you know, sweep all before them, which may well turn out to be the case. But we are where we are, and I think we absolutely deserve to be where we are this season. There's no luck about this. You know, this is not a question of, maybe the fixture list was a little bit kind in the early weeks of the season, but, you know, this is based on hard work. It's based on tactics and training ground and good recruitment and smart team building and squad building and all the rest of it. So this is no accident, and we should be pleased about where we are. And I think as well, we should take as much time as we can to enjoy what's going on, because, you know, football can change and things can change. I'm not being a downer in any way, but sometimes you need to just, you know, enjoy what's going on and not always look for I can't remember what I was going to say there. I just feel like we should enjoy this because it's
fun. Future permutations.
Yeah.
You know, what does this mean? I can't help but do a bit of that. Not so much regarding the title, but, you know, I look at the league table and yes, we're 1 point ahead of Man City and that's great, but we're 4 points ahead of Spurs. We're 8 points ahead of Chelsea, 9 points ahead of Man U, 14 points ahead of Liverpool. you know, this, these points that we're winning now, sure, let people talk about a title race, whatever. To be honest, I don't hear many Arsenal fans talking about that in a serious fashion at this point in time. But these points are precious, and these points will stand us in very good stead come the end of the season. So it's really interesting. You know, we've had so many questions in recent years about, you know, what does success look like for Arsenal? You know, where does this... How do we determine sort of gratification from following a football team in the Premier League? And I sort of think, I know it might sound absurd to some because, you know, what have we won? We've won nothing, right? We're just top of the league. But for me, this is sort of an incredibly gratifying period as an Arsenal fan, because almost everything you would want from your team. I mean, yeah, we all want silverware. We all want the big prizes, but we know, given the competition that exists, that can't possibly be the be-all and end-all. So then subsequently to that, it's like, what do you want? Well, you want a team that plays good football. You want a team that you like.
Mm-hmm.
You want a team that you identify that with. You know, maybe it's one that has homegrown or home nations players or academy young players who, you know, you associate with the club as being one of your own. Arsenal got plenty of all of those categories. You want a stadium that is full, you want a stadium that is rocking, and you want to win, you know, substantially more games than you lose.
Mm-hmm.
And Arsenal provide you with all those things right now. I mean, Jamie Redknapp, to be fair to him, on Sky said, if you're going to get a season ticket for anywhere in the Premier League, you'd want it to be here. And good luck to you, frankly, because people be queuing around the block to watch Arsenal at the present point in time. So,
yeah.
We should enjoy this. Like when you think about, or when I think about, I'll only speak for myself, but when I think about what I want from football and from my football club, Arsenal are delivering it to me at the present point in time.
I completely agree with you. You know, and the unfortunate thing about football at the moment is you do have to sort of take into account the... What's the word? Not the impossibility, but the reality of what is above you and what is likely to be above you for time immemorial. You know, as long as Man City have that investment and they have that, you know, that manager. And but you're absolutely right. Like, it's fun to watch Arsenal. It's fun to think about what we can do. It's fun to build up to the games. It's great to sit here on a podcast and talk to you about all the good stuff because, you know, we've had a period of time where a lot of it was very introspective and not necessarily in a good way. Whereas now we're looking at the best of what we can be. It's taken us a while to get here. There's always going to be some ups and downs, and there will be through the season. But right now it's just great fun to be an Arsenal fan, to watch what these players are trying to do on the pitch and these various and quite diverse characters within the side itself. And we'll maybe come to that in part two with a question or two. I think it's just a really nice mix of everything, like you say, everything you want from your football club. And if we can achieve silverware, if we can achieve tangible success, brilliant. You know, that's what we all want, and we all want to see trophies and everything else. But, you know, it feels like we're kind of reestablishing ourselves as a, in inverted commas, big club again, having gone through some doldrums. And, I'm, as they say, I'm here for it.
Yeah, and credit to the club for, you know, inspiring a lot of that turnaround. It's cost, you know, substantial amount of money too, but it is.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah. I say it hasn't happened by accident. It also hasn't happened for free.
No, it doesn't. But you know, you've got to spend money in a smart way and in the right way.
Mm.
And Arsenal, in terms of what they've done on the pitch, have really achieved that. We should enjoy it. We should enjoy it because, you know, inevitably there will be trickier times ahead, but this is a really fantastic time to be supporting Arsenal.
All right. Well, let's continue the enjoyment after a little break here. We're going to come back with your questions and more in part two right after this.
Hold up. Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
It's a brand new year, and what better time to get going with that online store you've been thinking of? Those "I was there when Arsenal actually scored a goal" t-shirts would fly off the shelves right now. And to get yourself up and running, you need Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage, all the way through to the did we hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% better compared to other leading commerce platforms, and sell more with less effort with thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Sign up for a $1 a month trial period at shopify.com/arsblog, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/arsblog now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/arsblog. Welcome back to the Arscast Extra. This is part two of the show where we answer questions that you send to us on Twitter at Gunnarblog and at Arsblog, and also on the Arsblog Discord chat server, which you get access to if you are an Arsblog member on Patreon. I did enjoy this from the Discord, from the legend of Sally Baba. And he said, "Are you concerned with Granit Xhaka's goal drought? It's been a couple of games now since a goal, and he's in danger of letting Haaland beat him to the golden boot if he doesn't pick up his form soon."
I am worried about it, but look, he keeps getting in good positions. So for any goal scorer, that's the key, right?
You know, yeah.
As long as he's taking up those positions, the XG will eventually do him justice and he'll get the goal return we all expect and demand.
All right, let me ask you this one then first. Optimistic Gunnar on the Discord says, "I completely get how this was a big test, showing our mettle, etc. But now we have a run of at least 7 extremely winnable games in all competitions. Is this the true test of what we're made of? Arsenal always seemed a team that others made an extra effort to bring their A game against, even when they've been playing poorly against worse opposition. Beating the likes of Leeds and Forest is surely where the true test of Champions League material comes from. After all, our wanker neighbours beat City last season and they're shit." So,
well, yeah. I mean, I guess this could carry on to the nth degree. You know, if we beat Southampton and Forest, then we'll have Chelsea next. And people say, aha, this is the true test. You know, you could say it about every game. And I do think that is sort of the case with the Premier League. Every game is a test. Every game is genuinely pretty challenging. It's quite a boring answer, but the real test is what can you do over 38 games, you know? What kind of consistency can you provide across the course of an entire campaign, particularly a campaign that is sliced in two by a World Cup? You know, as good as Arsenal are in this first half of the season, it's very difficult to kind of predict or imagine what Arsenal might return in January. It's almost two little mini seasons in a way. It's a bit reminiscent of when we had Project Restart. So, yeah, I mean, I know what the question's driving at, though. You know, Arsenal have beaten Tottenham and beaten Liverpool, and they go to Leeds and Southampton in the next fortnight. And there is a nagging part of my brain that thinks, well, I could see us dropping points in one of these games. I predicted it. I can't remember which one, but I think they're all tests, and I think these are different challenges. And away from home, you know, it's two league games away from home, off the back of Europa games. It will tell us a lot about how we handle that challenge of traveling and playing in Europe and then going away from home, what sort of depth we have to manage Thursday, Sunday. So it's going to be pretty instructive and pretty important. But I think that Leeds and Southampton in themselves as opponents, you know, Arsenal should feel confident of going there and beating those teams.
No, I agree. If you can play the way we played against Liverpool and beat Tottenham, and, you know, we've done well this season in general, you know, there should be confidence anyway. I think the thing not to do is get carried away. You don't start looking at Chelsea before you've played any of those games. You know what I mean? But it was very interesting to, you know, watch some of the players in their post-match interviews yesterday. The phrase du jour was game by game. We go game by game. Martinelli said it. Ben White said it. Maybe Saka said it as well. That it's just the next game. And I think that will be the mindset. I don't think Arteta is the kind of guy who's going to let anybody get carried away with anything. You know, you want to harness the positives. You want to harness the confidence and everything else. But at the same time, the minute there's a moment of complacency at Premier League level, you'll get found out. You'll get punished for it. So they'll be hammering that home, I'm sure, on the training ground. Like, well done. Enjoy that. Now forget it. Because we've got another game to win. So, you know, what you do against the sort of lesser lights obviously has a big impact on where you're going to end up. But if you take anything for granted, you know, you will drop points. So I think that's the way he'll be going at it.
We had a couple of questions like this today. Luke Kempner on the Discord said, I have a question. Do you think Tottenham beating us to the Champions League last season has actually been a wonderful gift in disguise? Now we can concentrate on the Prem and rest players for the Europa League. And Jake Chester on Twitter, do you think in the long run missing out on Champions League last season could be a net positive? We got the summer business done without the extra money, and the Europa League fixtures have given a chance to give real minutes to exciting squad players and rest the other players to help us secure top four.
Well, yeah, I mean, I can see the logic of that. And if we'd missed out on the Champions League to anyone else, it probably would be much easier to make that kind of rationalization, you know? But because it's them. Look, the question of how you use your squad has come up quite a bit in the last little while. And, you know, people were getting a bit upset about using first-team players in the Europa League games, you know, Tomiyasu coming on and playing a bit at left back, and Gabriel Jesus and Saka and everything else coming on. You know, it's just part and parcel of using the squad. So it might well suit us this season, because I'm not sure we've necessarily got the squad depth for Champions League games where you're having to play more of your first team players in midweek. You know, if you're playing a big team in midweek and you've got to play, let's say, Thomas Partey three times a week, can he do that? I'm not sure. Nobody is quite sure.
What we don't know is, you know, with the Champions League money, how much more work on the squad would we have undertaken?
Yeah.
But, you know, it may have been that it was just too big a job anyway to get the team competitive at Champions League level in the space of a summer. I think there's positive and negative to both. I think that obviously it was a huge negative, as you say, to miss out Spurs. But in a funny kind of way, that is proving massive motivation, I think, for the players this season. So
yeah, I mean, that's the one thing I will say, is that what that pain has manifested itself as this season is very interesting. Because it's nobody's feeling sorry for themselves. They want to put it right, you know? And failure can be a huge motivator. It really can. It can drive you because you don't want to experience that again. What was it Aaron Ramsdale said last week? They've got the fire inside because of the pain of last season, you know?
Yeah.
Nobody needs a fiery arse, you know? So, yeah, I mean, I think that from that perspective, it can be a positive in terms of you know, how we deal with this season ahead and what we're determined to do. I think there's definitely something to that.
I agree. I agree. Your question.
It's my question. Okay, we have had a couple like this, right? Letra on the Discord. How many yellows would you have handed Tsimikas? My count was on 3, and that was prior to him elbowing Gabriel Jesus in the face. And let me ask you first, did you think that was deliberate?
I've only seen it once or twice, but I didn't actually. I know that you did, didn't you?
Have you seen the angle that I posted on the blog this morning?
No, probably okay. Not.
Let me just send it to you. Will I do it in the chat here?
Yeah, okay.
Okay,
yeah.
There we go. And have a look at that and tell me if you think it was deliberate or not.
Here we go. Ah, this one, yeah. I mean, it may have been, looking at that. Mm. That looks more deliberate than the angle I saw through the coverage I watched last night. It was a scary moment, to be honest, because was this the one where Jesus went down and...
Yeah.
To be honest, I was surprised he played on.
Well, that I've got some follow-on questions from that. 2_KS said, what did you make of the decision to let Jesus stay in after the knock he took? The way he hit the ground seemed really unnatural, similar to when an MMA fighter gets their bell rung.
Yeah.
And let me see. I think it was QC Gooner. Goodly morning. As much as we all love Gabriel Jesus, can we also not admit that he should not have come back into the game? Does the Premier League have any sort of concussion protocol to take these decisions out of the player's hands and given to a third-party neurologist on site for games, etc., etc.? He said, I'm spitballing here, but after watching the horrors of the Miami Dolphins quarterback, Tua, whose name I can't pronounce, going back into a game with clear concussion, I worry for player safety.
I do too. The Premier League told us that Gabriel Jesus passed all the necessary on-field tests.
Do we know if he was unconscious?
We don't know for sure.
Right.
But all I know is that he reportedly passed the on-field checks that he needed to in order to continue playing. Are those on-field checks stringent enough? I don't know. You know, I know anecdotally some people in the medical profession were a bit surprised that he was allowed to continue playing. Because I agree, you know, if a boxer went down like that, fight's over. I mean, he was not like his body went completely limp, right?
Mm.
It was like the life had just gone out of him. So I did find myself looking at it going like, if he was a less important player, would he be playing on? You know, yeah, I am slightly uneasy with it. And I don't wish to cast aspersions on, you know, any of the professionals involved. It's just a case of do the Premier League and do the authorities take these kind of head injuries seriously enough?
Yeah. I mean, the question is, if he was unconscious, if he was actually knocked out, he should not be playing. He should not be continuing. I don't think that's the right thing. And I think you might have a point about the importance of the player. Of course, we don't know 100% if he was unconscious or not. It did look like, from where he was getting treatment, that it was his nose.
Yeah.
So maybe... Yeah. Maybe...
He may have just taken a big bang on the nose.
Yeah.
I mean, you know...
It could have been like a... It could have been like a pain... how do you say this? Like, did you ever... Like, I think there's, maybe I'm wrong here, I don't know, but it strikes me that maybe, like, if you get a punch in the side of the head and you're knocked unconscious immediately versus one where you get, like, a bit of overwhelming pain and you kind of zone out into, like, a slight bit of unconsciousness, are those things different? I don't know.
Not sure. But
I'm not sure.
I do think the way he went to ground, I mean, again, I'm not an expert, but to me was... more symptomatic of someone who, you know, has suffered a concussion. But I think all we can do is have faith in the medical professionals on the scene and hope that the appropriate checks were taken. I think that the Premier League have tried to introduce, you know, more stringent guidelines around this, but I think they are still way behind a number of sports. And what's interesting is now the Premier League attracts so much attention in the States, And I actually think, you know, leagues like the NFL are much more conscious of this issue.
Well, maybe. Talk to the Miami Dolphins guy.
Yeah, sure.
I'm just watching it again here. He does go down like a sack of spuds, doesn't he?
Yeah.
I mean, the thing about it is there are protocols. I mean, you can now make concussion subs.
Yeah.
So if he was deemed unfit or if he was unconscious, it wouldn't cost Arsenal a sub to bring somebody on, which I wonder, is that essentially moot now in the five sub era? That it doesn't cost you as much anyway, but
a little bit. Would it be better if it was a case that you are allowed to substitute someone for 5 minutes so that you can properly assess them? Do you know what I mean? Under the current guidelines, the player's sustained a head injury can't be returned to the field of play. You know, that is why clubs are always going to be tempted to leave them on. And see how they do. Whereas if you could get them in a room, put them under proper assessment, and then make a final decision,
yeah,
that might be more sensible. But
yeah.
It was a worrying one, and it may have been deliberate on Tsimikas's part. Looking at that replay, regardless, I think I was quite uncomfortable with him continuing.
No, I don't think he was right either. After the after the whack. Yeah. He wasn't quite, you know, where you would expect him to be. But then late on, he goes in and he gets sandwiched between Alisson and Van Dijk. Yeah. He's a brave lad. He really is a brave player. And I think that the way he did that, whether he should have been on the pitch or not, sort of epitomizes what he brings to the team and the way that he is trying to raise standards, as people have talked about. Obviously, his quality as a footballer is one thing, but the mentality, maybe it's misplaced when you've been knocked out, if he's been knocked out. But, you know, that bravery should be something his teammates look at and think, well, look, if he's doing that, you know, I can't be the guy who's found wanting in that regard. You know what I mean?
Absolutely, yeah. He is just sensational. I mean, I've spoken to so many fans of other clubs who've marvelled at his performances. Now, outside of Haaland and probably Harry Kane, I don't think there's a centre forward playing at Gabriel Jesus's level in the league right now. He's been so excellent, and you know his willingness to fight for every ball. You know, a 60-yard pass lumped at him, and he's centre halves who are 6 inches taller and ostensibly more physical, and the way he battles, the way he uses his body. There were moments in the game yesterday where when he had the ball at his feet inside the penalty box, you could tell Liverpool defenders were terrified of what he might do. Almost shades of Jamie Carragher, you know, sort of being thrown this way and that by Thierry Henry. He's just been really complete and really outstanding, his performances. And let's hope that he's looked after this week.
Sure.
And nurse back to health, because we desperately need him.
Yep, for sure.
Bit of a change of pace.
Okay.
Ashley Moss on Twitter says, with the video of Aubameyang's views on Arteta circulating at the weekend, is Oba just a bitter man, or do you think he has a point, and do you think he has tarnished his Arsenal legacy in any way? Have you seen this video?
Yeah, if people haven't seen the video, it was doing the rounds. I don't quite understand or know fully the context of it, right?
No, I've got no idea where it's from.
He's basically sitting in a room with two guys, or three guys, because there's two guys that we can see on camera, and then there's obviously somebody else filming. And I don't know what the context of that meeting is or what they're doing, and they're shooting the breeze about Arsenal. What I would say is I would imagine that at no point did Aubameyang think what he said in that room was going to be released to the public, right? So,
I think it's a jeweler's. I think he's with a jeweler buying some jewelry, and I think it might be for their own YouTube channel, but I'm not 100% on that.
Right. I still don't think he was expecting anything he said to be released.
No.
Sorry, I just dropped a pen. It's quite funny, isn't it, that he's talking about how Arteta can't handle big characters and he needs young players around them because young players will do what they're told. And then two 21-year-olds do what they did yesterday. Mm. You know, Bukayo Saka, Gabriel Martinelli. It just sort of makes a complete lie of that, you know? Martin Odegaard, still a young player. William Saliba, who we've spoken about. This is a team full of young players, and it's top of the table.
And a team with plenty of big characters, yeah, well, that's, I would say as well.
That is the difference. It's like, what is your definition of a big character or being able to handle a big character? Like him or loathe him, as some people do, I would say Granit Xhaka is a big character, mm-hmm. right? You're telling me Aaron Ramsdale isn't a big character?
Mm.
You know, there are players in this team, and I mentioned it, like there's some, like Ben White, who I'm going to ask you a question about now in a minute as well. But, you know, there are characters in this team. So a big character, depending on your definition, you know, might be a player who is a troublemaker. I'm not saying that that's what Aubameyang is or was or anything like that. But, you know, that's sort of what the perception of that comment is, isn't it? You've got to be able to handle the big guys. You've got to be able to handle the guy who doesn't, you know, doesn't always do what he's told, who doesn't do what you say, you know, who doesn't follow the rules, who doesn't turn up for training on time because, let's say, they've got a special talent, which Aubameyang, you know, had as a goal scorer, but doesn't really have that anymore, right? So I just think it's quite... It doesn't stack up, you know? You can be a big character and you can be a positive in the dressing room. But if you're a big character that's more hassle than it's worth, well, we know what happens to you at Arsenal. You're gone.
That's it. And I think we all, you know, we all have stories about our own lives that we tell ourselves to kind of make sense of events. And I think this is probably Aubameyang's, but I'm not sure it really stands up to huge scrutiny. I mean, to be fair to him, I think if you replace the word character with stars, you know, big mm-hmm. stars, then I think maybe there is a case that, you know, Arteta doesn't like working with stars who think they're an exception to the rules. What I would say is, does Pep Guardiola, does Jurgen Klopp, do you get the sense that there's anybody at Manchester City or at Liverpool who exists outside of the standards that are set by the coach?
Mm, good point.
I don't think so. And I think that's the kind of culture he wants to build. And the other thing I would say is that, you know, when Arteta came into the club, he tried to integrate Ozil into the team. It was one of the first things he did, brought him back into the side. He, you know, embraced Aubameyang as captain, gave him a 3-year contract on huge money, went over, signed that deal. He was telling people the manager was a big part of why he
my manager. My manager, isn't that
my
what
my manager.
Said,
yeah. So I don't think it's quite accurate to be like, you know, fundamentally Arteta won't work with these big players. I just think it's when they fall foul of the standards he expects, things go awry.
Well, the other thing to say, right, is that in his very first press conference, when he first arrived at the club, Mikel Arteta made it very, very, very clear to the public what he expected from everybody at the football club in terms of how they work and how they behave. And, you know, he said, like, how we live together. Do you remember?
Yeah.
And that was in a press conference, or that was in an interview with Arsenal.com or whatever. Can you imagine how much he stressed that within the club itself?
Yeah.
You know, in training, in the meetings that they have, you know, in the various ups and downs that they've experienced during his time in charge, none of them would be under any illusions about what's expected from them in terms of their behavior and their work and their commitment. And to sort of mouth off about it when basically you've been cast aside because you did not live up to those standards is a bit much. And I think, you know, people would be a lot more sympathetic to what Aubameyang said if Arsenal were struggling in mid-table. And people say we could use a guy like Aubameyang now. Nobody's saying that. We're top of the table without him.
Mm.
You know? So it kind of rings pretty hollow. And I'm sure he's still not happy about what happened and how his time at Arsenal came to an end. Does it damage his legacy? I don't know. Maybe a little bit. Depends on the person. Yeah, like I'm happy to remember him as the guy who scored two goals in the FA Cup semi-final, two goals in the FA Cup final, you know, made a big contribution, and then for whatever reason, it started to dwindle and diminish. You can't take that away from him, but he's now a Chelsea player, and I've got no interest in that sort of side of his life or career anymore.
It's a bad time for those comments to leak from an Oba perspective. Do you know what I mean? If Arsenal were struggling or hadn't scored goals or Arteta was a bit less held in high regard, maybe they'd gain more traction. But, you know, coming out the same weekend that Arsenal beat Liverpool just after beating Spurs, I think they'll disappear just as quickly as they emerged.
Jesus of Yarnum, who's at Jesus of Yarnum, said Ben White on Bein Sports. He seemed cold, almost pathologically so. Do you think it was due to his impression of how the media never gave him a chance and how, even now, after adapting to right back and producing high standards, no one raves about him? And we had some question on the Discord about this as well. Let me see if I can find it. Boomer Gooner said, is Ben White the most boring / least enthusiastic post-match interview since Aaron Ramsey? And I was looking at this going, are you crazy? Ben White did an interview, you know, where he talked about how things were different this year and
everything else.
It was a really good interview. I enjoyed it. I enjoyed the way he carried himself in that interview. But he also did another interview with Norwegian TV, Jan Arge Fjortoft again, who's doing all the post-match interviews and stuff, which I thought was just fucking hilarious. It was really, really funny. So I'm going to play a little clip of it here. Ben White was talking about how family, you know, the Arsenal group, you know, they're all pulling together. They're all going game by game. We're all a family here. That was another thing that was doing the rounds in the post-match interviews. And this is what we got next.
But still, family don't win football games, so you need that extra thing there to get out of jail when you're down to 2-2. What does that say of the moral of this Arsenal team?
Yeah, obviously we're quite good at football as well as being a family, so that helps. You know, the signings that are coming this season have been amazing, helped massively, and you know the team that we've got, people coming on from the bench and finishing the game for us is vital.
It's not very often that you see a team starting with four attackers, as I did from the start there at Liverpool. Did that surprise you, or were you just seeing that as a challenge with all the strikers?
Yeah, to be fair, I didn't really notice. I had what I had to do, and you know, I was so focused on that, everything else just goes on.
I love that. I like it. What do you think of the four Liverpool? Like, oh, I didn't really notice. I love him. I fucking love him. He's brilliant. He's so deadpan in those interviews. And it's obviously quite deliberate, you know. Did you see?
Yeah, he's a really interesting character.
Yeah.
So Arteta won't work with him, I wouldn't think. but no, he conducts himself with the air of someone who knows, who has sort of supreme confidence in his own ability. I think that much is really evident. But also who knows that football maybe just isn't quite the be all and end all, you know, and who sort of refuses to partake in the sort of dramatics that exist around it it at times. I think it's very, very healthy, and it gives him a real sort of psychological robustness, which he takes into his job.
Mm.
I thought he was brilliant again.
Oh, me too. Yesterday. Me too. Like, yeah. I think the biggest compliment you can pay Ben White, when you see Tomiyasu play the way he played yesterday at left back, the fact that Ben White is keeping a player of that quality out of the team at right back is a real testament to just how good he has been this season.
Yeah. And he's adding stuff, you know, you think of him as a centre half playing right back, tucking in, playing in midfield. He's adding these driving, overlapping runs to the byline where he's really dangerous and difficult to live with. I mean, I think back to the opening game of the season, we talked about, oh, Zaha's going to be on the left against Ben White.
Yeah,
how's he going to handle it? And then you think in the last couple of weeks, he's played up against Son And then he's played up against Luis Diaz and Jota in the course of this game. And we haven't really given that much consideration or flagged it as a huge worry yeah. at any point. So I think that tells you how much he's excelling. And yeah, I just think he's a supremely confident footballer, and rightfully so.
Yeah. And I think a big character. I think he actually is.
Yeah.
You know, in many ways, we've got these different kinds of characters within the squad. And they all seem to blend very nicely. I enjoyed the bit after Saka's penalty, where they're in the huddle and he just comes in late and then whacks Granit Xhaka about three times in the back of the head. I don't know, you know, what exactly to make of that, except to laugh, because it's just very funny.
Yeah, he's funny. He's a really funny guy.
Yeah.
And yeah, but he was also fantastic on the field yesterday. Really, really good.
Yeah. Loved him.
What have I got here? Well, let's have a nervous question. David Barrett on Twitter said, anyone else nervous about backups for Ramsdale, Partey and Jesus? The rest of the team feels like a movable feast, but with those three, it feels their absence would be huge. When Ramsdale went down injured and camera cuts Turner, it did not feel great.
I agree with that. I texted you, I think, I just like, uh-oh, when Ramsdale went down, because,
it's one of the areas of the squad where the quality of backup that Arsenal have available is less certain. You know, there's only so much we can know about Matt Turner, really, as English football fans at this point in time.
For sure. I mean, we haven't seen a lot of him. I thought he was good with his hands against Bodo Glimt. Not quite as good with his feet. But then it was interesting to note that Ramsdale played it pretty long most of the time yesterday. Mm-hmm. And I think that's partly because Liverpool were playing four attackers. And, you know, if you play it short out from the back and you beat that press, then, you know, you're in good shape. But that is a difficult press to beat with those players. So I think there was something common sense about that as well. Yes, I mean, look, I do worry a little bit about backup for Ramsdale. But when you look at the other teams in the Premier League and what they've got as backup goalkeepers, I don't know that they've got much better than we do, you know?
True.
And the presence of your first choice goalkeeper is sort of taken as a given. I would be a little more concerned with the Partey one more than the Jesus one. Because I do think Eddie is making progress, and we saw last season, like, he's not Gabriel Jesus, don't get me wrong, but I'd feel more confident about that position or our ability to deal with the absence of Jesus more than I would feel confident about our ability to deal with the absence of Partey. But this is where I think January becomes very interesting. You know, we've got, what, 3-4 weeks just over until we break for the World Cup. And in that period, you know, before football starts again on the 26th of December, there's certainly plenty of time for Mikel Arteta and Edu to lay the groundwork for potential recruitment in January, isn't there? And early recruitment in January. I'm not talking about, like, will we get somebody on deadline day? I'm talking about, like, the kind of signing that maybe we were looking to make during the summer, whether it's Douglas Luiz or somebody else. You know, we wanted to make that signing in the summer. We also wanted to bring in a winger during the summer as well, and didn't get to do either of those two things. But this break in the season, as weird as it's going to be, gives you the opportunity to spend some time doing that, because you're not tied up in that Thursday, Sunday schedule. You know, you've got nothing to do. Some training, obviously, and some behind closed doors games and everything else, but it's going to be a weird period in the season. But perhaps an opportunity, if Arsenal go into, you know, the last part of this first part of the season in good shape, then you can address those issues. So I'm not necessarily that worried about it now, because I think there is a chance to do something about it in a way that there wouldn't normally be.
Yeah, I think that's going to be really interesting. Really interesting. But yeah, those are the those are the three, I think, that worry me most in terms of their availability, because I just think their qualities are... I mean, I accept Eddie's doing well, but I think Jesus has already become a bit of a talisman for this team. I think psychologically to lose him would be a blow. And to be fair, I think you'd have to start thinking about Granit Xhaka in that category as well. You know, is there someone who could step in and play his role as well as him, as effectively, with all the other kind of, you know, leadership elements he brings?
Mm.
I don't know. So, yeah, it's going to be a testing period in that respect. Let's hope those guys can stay fit. Ramsdale is fine, by the way. There's no ill effects from whatever it was he felt in that first
time. Okay, well, that's good. That's good. Here's one from Ali Boy, Alistair Wood at Ali Boy 82. He said there have been media reports that Arsenal have contract options to extend Saka and Saliba to 2025 and Martinelli to 26. Has James heard anything to suggest this is true? And if so, does this help us get them to sign new deals this season? While Emperor Bumblewank, who's at Capable of Flight, said, rank the contract importance: Martinelli, Saka, Saliba.
Oh, wow, that's a lot. The contract options thing, I believe is true. I can't say it. I haven't seen the contracts, but, people, you know, who I trust tell me that that is correct. And in fact, the news David Ornstein wrote today in his column about Charlie Patino having a +2 option within his contract, it gives me some reassurance that the same could exist for Martinelli. It is unusual, but perhaps this is something Arsenal have been working on and trying to do for some time.
Yeah.
Seems there are multiple instances. How much does that help? I don't think it helps that much, because the issue is not that someone like Martinelli's contract is close to expiry, but that he's being paid a sum that is not really representative of his importance to the team anymore.
Sure.
And there's a gap there that Arsenal have to close. So I think that has to happen kind of irrespective of the contract length. You know, you could say, well, you're under contract until 2027, but why would you want a player unhappy, you know, feeling like they deserve more for too long? I just don't think that's good management of the situation.
Yeah.
They start looking around for other offers, frankly.
Yeah.
What is the most important? Who is the three? Martinelli, Saka, Saliba?
Yeah.
Really hard to separate. Really hard to separate. I guess I would say I consider Saka the most important, because to me he is sort of the symbol of the club and the project, probably a future Arsenal captain, one of our most important players already. I think sort of to lose him would be heartbreaking. Saliba, you'd say probably next importance, just because he's got slightly less time on the contract than Martinelli. And I think, you know, with Saka and Martinelli, they've both been fantastic, but there is kind of a, you know, Saliba's offers you something very different at the other end of the pitch. And then Martinelli, just because he's got the longest potential time on his deal, maybe slightly less of a priority. But let me be clear, they are all massive priorities. And if Arsenal can get those done in the next few months, what a bonus, what a lift, what a message that would send.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right to point out that, you know, I've seen people saying, well, why would William Saliba sign a new contract with Arsenal when, you know, he could attract offers from elsewhere? But he is probably, and is obviously, underpaid based on the contract that he signed when he joined the club as an 18-year-old. And part of why he might sign a new deal is a very substantial increase in wages. Now, I don't know if these contracts sometimes have like a raise built in. So if you do the option, you pay, you know, you get paid more. You know, they often do.
There'll be like a buy clause for Arsenal. Yeah. So either it'll be a lump sum or it'll mean an increased salary. Yeah.
Yeah. But look, I think the three of them are now so important. Three 21-year-olds that you're looking to secure long-term because of what they bring you at both ends of the pitch. You know, I find it hard to rank them, but I'd sort of go along with yours in the sense that, like, Martinelli, because he's got the longest contract, is maybe the least important, which isn't to say it's not important. But Saka, get him tied down, because he is just so crucial to this team. And Saliba, I think if you secure him, you get those three tied down, yeah, everyone's going to be party poppers out, right?
For sure.
All right.
For sure.
Okay, we have got to go. We've got to call it quits here because there are things to do, people to see, places to go and all that kind of stuff. And we want to get this podcast out to you guys as quickly as we can. So as ever, thank you so much indeed for listening. Hope you enjoyed the show. Hope you enjoyed the game. Hope you're enjoying what's going on at the moment as much as we're enjoying talking about it. Plenty to come this week as well, of course. Europa League action and lots more. We'll keep you up to date on Patreon and beyond. For now, though, thank you, and we will catch you on the next one.
Bye-bye.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.